Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast, and I'm recording this episode after the conclusion of Hugo's There podcast 1.0, which is where I work my way through the list of Hugo winners of the Best Novel Award. Since that time, I have actually been nominated. This podcast has been nominated for Best Fancast for 2023, which is super exciting. Hopefully you heard that in the feed. I did record that episode prior to the official list coming out because there was a sort of an unofficial one that wasn't supposed to come out, but water under the bridge. But Hugo's There 1.0 was in the past. Hugo's There 2.0 is coming soon. And in between, we have my Ask Me Anything episode. I collected questions through the survey that I sent out a while back, and I've gotten some other questions along the line in various forms. So I'm going to go ahead and go through these, and not in any particular order, really. I did allow people to submit questions and feedback anonymously. So for some of these, I will have a name that I will refer to. And for others, I'm just going to tell you that it's anonymous. Okay. So I thought I'd start off with one of the kind of more technical ones that I have here, and that is a question from Ivor that is asking, what equipment and tech do you use for the whole podcast from end to end? So this is, you know, it's a simple kind of pragmatic thing. I will try and put a couple photos in the show notes so that you can see some of my setup. But what I'm recording into here is a Samson Q2U microphone. It's the same form factor as the Audio-Technica ATR2100. I have three of those as well that I use for Take Me to Your Reader. And you know, it's a decent mic. I wouldn't mind in the future upgrading to a Rodecaster or something that is a little more dynamic, has a little more noise canceling. When James and Colin and I are in a room together, we do get some bleed through into each other's microphones, and that makes editing more complicated than it would otherwise be. But the thing that makes it less complicated is the digital recorder that we have called a Zoom PodTrack P4. It's a four-channel recorder, so you can record in person with four XLR mics. By the way, I guess I could mention that the ATR2100 and the Samson Q2U both will do either USB or XLR. And so you have the flexibility of just plugging it in and, you know, jumping on a call, or you can plug it into a mixer and then take the mixer into the computer, which is what I'm essentially doing now with the PodTrack P4. I have it plugged into my computer via USB, and then my microphone is plugged in with XLR. But the really handy thing about the PodTrack P4 is that it has two digital lines in it. So line 3 can be switched and used for a phone. So if I wanted to call someone on my phone and record that line on the digital recorder, I can do that. And then line 4 can be switched so that it essentially is the remote guest. And so James and Colin and I can all be on channels 1, 2, 3, and then line 4 can be our remote guest for Take Me to Your Reader. It's really handy because then we can all just plug our headphones into the PodTrack P4. It has four headphone outputs, and we can all hear our remote guest. Remote guest can hear us. It's really, really handy. We had this very kludgy solution prior to that for having remote guests. But it also makes it so that it gives me a backup for every recording that I do for Hugo's There when I'm doing with a remote guest, and I've only done in-person recordings 3 or 4 times. I do use Zencastr as well for recording, so most of the time that's how I host the call, using Zencastr, and then I use the digital recording as a backup just in case something goes bad. And it has gone bad before, so it's nice to have a backup. I also have a good set of headphones that I use for my calls. I think mine are called One Audio is the brand. I got them for Christmas. I have some soundproofing tiles on my wall as well. And I have a Lenovo ThinkPad that I use for my main machine. I used to record using an Asus laptop that was running Linux, actually. So if you ever want to talk about that kind of stuff, I think I was running Fedora. Might have been Ubuntu. I think it was Fedora. Currently, it's a Windows laptop. So then for editing, I use Audacity because it's free. And really, it's pretty intuitive to use. There's a couple nice tools in it. My favorite one is the Truncate Silence tool. That allows me to really tighten up a podcast. So lots of times it takes an hour and a half to record one, but there's some pauses and that kind of stuff in there. Truncate Silence will just remove all those pauses, and it just makes us sound more eloquent. So I, of course, also do some noise cancellation using Audacity. So then in terms of the actual mechanics of how I produce the podcast from there, I export from Audacity as WAV, and then I run it through a tool called CN Levelator, Connections Network Levelator. It's still out there for download. It's not being maintained anymore, but it does a good job of sort of normalizing and compressing the output so that you always get a consistent volume level on every podcast. The last thing you want to do is break somebody's eardrums because your podcast is too low and they have to crank it up. And then when their player plays the next track, it blows them out. So word to the wise for podcasters, make sure that you do some normalization. After that, then I re-import it back into Audacity and export as MP3, and then I upload it to my website, which is hosted on Bluehost, and I'm running WordPress with a plugin called Seriously Simple Podcasting, also called Castos, I think, at this point. They actually offer hosting as well, I believe. I mentioned Zencastr. Zencastr actually does have a hosting capability on it at this point. It didn't when I first started using it, so I may, in the Hugo's There 2.0 time frame, start hosting some files over there. Because one thing you can do is create rooms, and so I could create essentially sub-podcasts for the various sorts of things that I do here. So if I wanted to have one, I could just put the Comfort Reads episodes in there. I could do sort of the bonus episodes where I'm just catching up with previous guests, the occasional kind of author interviews that I do or interview a scientist, that kind of thing. I could put those in a separate feed as well. And then one, of course, for the main episodes that I do here. So I may start doing that. I'll let you know if I do. So that's basically it from end to end. All right, so I'll move on to another question. So in case you notice that I sound slightly different between questions here, it's because I'm recording this over multiple days. Okay, so moving on to some more practical stuff, Bob wrote in that I would like to see a detailed explanation of how Hugos and Nebulas are awarded and how they differ. How did the Hugo Award come to be the dominant science fiction prize, seemingly eclipsing the Nebula? And then he says, back in the 70s and 80s, when I really got into science fiction, the Nebula was at least equivalent and maybe more prestigious. Now, judging by the attention given in the Hugo, in podcasts alone, Hugos rule. So how did this happen? I'm not sure that I can speak too much to the predominance of the Hugo these days. I think it's kind of a natural evolution given the difference between the awards. And the main difference is that the Hugos are awarded by the Worldcon and voted on and nominated by the members of the Worldcon. So it's a fan award by fans. Whereas the Nebula Award is given by the Science Fiction Writers of America, and therefore it's a more professional award. So it's pretty easy to see in the internet age, essentially, that fans get to vote on an award, and so then they prefer that award. I don't know that that's the case, but I think it's a good stab at what might be happening there. So if for anybody who's not aware, for the Hugos, like I said, anyone who buys a Worldcon membership, which can be, I think, as little as $50 US, to become a nominating and voting member. This isn't an attending membership. This is just something that you can do to actually nominate and vote. So anyone who does that can submit their choices for nominees, and then once the shortlist is determined based on the number of nominees that are in, the Hugo voters, Worldcon members, get to vote with a ranked choice voting system. I'll put some links in the show notes to some of the stuff that explains and goes into great detail about how the automatic runoff system works and how the ranked choice works. Very cool, actually. I think it would be nice if some nations used that system for their voting. But yeah, like I said, a key factor here is that you don't actually have to attend Worldcon to nominate and vote. And I think the way it works is if you, like for instance, if you have a 2023 membership, you can nominate and vote for 2023, and then you also get to nominate for 2024. So the way, in terms of the mechanics that it actually works, going into a little more detail here, once the nomination window is open, voters get access to the nomination area of the Worldcon site, and then they just get to nominate whatever they like in any of the categories for which somebody has things to nominate. There's a great spreadsheet from Lady Business that kind of catalogs eligible works, and it's crowdsourced. So, you know, if you go to the Fancast category, for instance, you'll find this podcast in there because somebody put it in there, which is nice. I didn't do it myself, just for the record. And then there's lots of stuff. It's very, very useful for short fiction and for graphic stories and other stuff like that. There's one interesting quirk to Hugo voting is that you can vote no award. So if there's a category where you don't think that any of the nominees in that category are worthy, you can just vote for nothing. I've actually never voted no award. I think people do put that in their rankings. For instance, if they think that 3 out of 5 of the nominees are worthy, they put those above no award, but then actually use no award. I've never done that. I don't understand how that's different from just voting for 3 and not voting for anything else. Maybe somebody can help me figure out how that's different. Juan would know. Juan San Miguel. One cool thing, though, is after the Hugo ceremony, after the Hugos are given out, there's always a publication that comes out that shows the nomination and voting process. So you can kind of see where you were in the voting, see how close you were to winning, see how close you were, for instance, making the shortlist. I've been able to watch my podcast move up the long list over the last couple of years prior to this year finally making it onto the shortlist. And then in terms of the way the voting works for the nebulas, I actually wasn't able to find a ton of information on that. I will just put a link to the Nebula Award website and the Science Fiction Writers of America website, and you can check that out for yourself. But the main difference is fan versus professional. So Ben asked, how do you find the Worldcon? I'm just an ordinary guy who likes science fiction. Are people friendly? Well, everything that I've seen from friends who have attended Worldcon is that it looks awesome. J.W. Wartick went last year, took a ton of pictures, posted a lot of stuff on social media about his, I think it was his first Worldcon. Hugo Girl, they went last year, maybe the last 2 years, I can't remember. And everything that I've heard is that it's a great experience, and I would really like to go at some point. All right, so moving on to some sort of retrospective kind of stuff. I have a group of similar questions, so I'm just going to read the questions, and then I'll ramble about all of them. So one of the questions that I have, and I don't have a name attached to this one. One thing I'd be really interested in is a Seth retrospective on the Hugo rankings. What books were the biggest surprise or disappointment, themes from Hugo winners that you noticed, differences in decades of science fiction, that sort of thing. And then Russ asked, which book did your opinion change about the most as you went through this project? And then which book was most overrated, i.e. another book should have won the Hugo that year. And then Bob says, what book did you review that surprised you the most? So there's some similar things in here. And I'm not sure that I'm the right person to ask about if the right or wrong book won the Hugo. Only in a couple of cases had I read any substantial number of the nominees. That's something that I'm going to talk to J.W. Wartick about, because I know that he is at least very close to finishing having read all of the nominees for the Hugos. And so I'm going to have him on for an episode, and we'll talk about that subject. For me, let's see, opinions changing about a book as I went through the project. I think kind of my biggest surprise overall, and this was what Bob asked, what book surprised you the most? I think my biggest surprise was probably Double Star by Heinlein. I had heard a lot of negative things about Heinlein. I had one of my guests who said she hated Heinlein, and I've never really had a negative experience with any Heinlein books that I've read or short stories that I've read, but some of them can be of a type. And Double Star is very different from some of his other work. And I just found it charming and enjoyable more than I would have guessed. Based on the title, I thought it was, you know, hard science fiction kind of thing. But it's really just about politics and tolerance. And I don't know, I really loved that book. I think a close second there would be Foundation's Edge, because I hadn't really enjoyed the Foundation series up to that point. I had read Foundation a long time ago, didn't really jive with it. And so when I reread it for the podcast, I tried to do my best to enjoy it, and more or less had a good time reading it. It didn't live up to, I think, the hype. And this kind of goes into some of the, you know, disappointments, because a book can have an amazing reputation, and when you get to it, and then it kind of just washes over and you go, eh, that's a bummer. Because I don't like being on the outside like that. I'm not the kind of person who likes to have hot takes about things. Not really. But yeah, Foundation just kind of, I worked my way through that series, and all the way up through, you know, Foundation and Earth and Second Foundation, I was just kind of hanging in there doing the homework. And that's really what it was. It was homework for doing Foundation's Edge, since that's the first of the actual Hugo winners in there. Unless, of course, you count The Mule, which is a retro Hugo winner. And I think I covered The Mule after. I'd have to go back and look. But it was surprising to me that then I read Foundation's Edge and really, really enjoyed it. And I think there's something in there, and I think I talked about it on the episode, that the difference in the way you read a book that's been serialized and one that was written as a novel originally. And that, I think, just shows up in the way the book is structured. Where with Foundation, I had a hard time keeping the thread of what was going on because it was so episodic. Biggest just delightful find during the podcast was the Vorkosigan novels. I haven't hit a dud yet in that series. And I've listened to the entire series. I've read a few of them as I've gone through the podcast as well. But if I wanted to say the most kind of overrated or disappointments that I have in this, and this is where it gets into hot take territory, the Uplift books, Neuromancer. These are books that have enormous reputations, and I bounced off of them. And I didn't have the chance to bounce off of them. Like someone, if a casual person just reading these books could go, I'm not into that, and stop reading it. I didn't have that chance. And so I had to essentially slog through books that weren't working for me. And I'm sure that colors my opinion of those books as well. With Neuromancer, I really tried. I read it in print, and then I was like, I didn't really get that. What's going on? And then I got the audiobook and listened to it and thought, maybe I missed something. Nope. And kind of bounced off the audiobook as well. And yeah, I think it's just, you know, everybody has opinions. Everybody has things that they like. And it just happened that the Uplift books and Neuromancer were not things that I liked. I may revisit them at some point. I kind of doubt it. Neuromancer, maybe. Probably not the Uplift books. One book that I definitely did change my mind on, and I'm glad I wrote this down. This is kind of at the bottom of what I had written down for this. The Diamond Age by Neal Stephenson. It was something that a coworker of mine, a friend of mine, had recommended to me years ago. He handed me the book. It had a note in it that said, start reading here and be flabbergasted. And I was, but not the way he intended. I just was like, I have no idea what I'm reading. This is weird. And didn't care for it. Read a little bit of it in print and handed it back to him. I said, I don't think this is my thing. And then later on, he gave me an audiobook of it. I started listening to the audiobook. It still really wasn't working for me. And then when I got down to do it for the podcast, I just kind of dedicated myself to get in the mood for it and figure it out. And it really worked for me. I really, really ended up enjoying it. Then I listened to the audiobook again. And once I kind of knew what I was getting into, yeah, found it really enjoyable. So that was fun. Okay. A similar topic sort of here. Do you ever DNF books? Do you ever do not finish books? Yes, absolutely. I didn't allow myself to do it for this podcast. So for none of these books did I not actually finish it. But I learned my lesson once when I finished a book that I had from the library back before our public library stopped levying fines. Because, of course, a 15, 30, 45 cent fine is not a hardship for a person who is fully employed, right, and makes a good living. It is a hardship for somebody who is using the library because they can't afford to buy books. And so I'm glad that our libraries have gotten away from doing fines. But I had it out from the library. I had this particular book out from the library. It was The Historian by Elizabeth Kostova, I think is the name. I did not have a good time reading it, but I was like 250, 300 pages into it, and it's due back at the library, and I know I'm going to have to pay a fine when I take it back to the library. And so I fell into the sunk cost fallacy of reading, and I pressed through and finished it over the next couple of days, paid my, I don't know, 30 or 45 cent fine, and it was not worth it. So that was where I realized life is too short to finish books that you're not enjoying. Obviously, when you're doing it for the podcast, that's the kind of thing that you don't want to do. Fortunately, I mostly enjoyed the books that I read for the podcast. Okay, here's another one, another anonymous one. What have you typically done between podcast books? Meaning what? Probably what I've read. The honest answer is other podcast books for Take Me to Your Reader. I did try to, once I really got into doing Hugo's There and still doing Take Me to Your Reader, I asked the guys, hey, can we do some things that I've read before so that I can just, you know, pick up an audiobook or not even reread anything and just watch a movie? Or can we do stuff that's based on short fiction? And so we did a lot of that. And maybe that shortchanged that podcast, although I still feel like we picked interesting titles. But that's one thing, obviously, that I still have to keep up with the reading for Take Me to Your Reader. And then generally in between my podcast reading for Hugo's There and anything that I was doing for Take Me to Your Reader, I had to do quick stuff. And so lots of times I would pick up a trade of a comic, sometimes, you know, an ebook, but the same kind of thing. So graphic novels. I started working my way through some of the more famous graphic novels. For instance, I did Watchmen at some point, but you know, that one is an undertaking. It's quite long. But usually I would just go and, you know, pick up a trade of usually DC Comics because that's my preferred comics, though I've read some of the classics of Marvel as well. And it was something that would just let me read, sort of pleasure read, without having to invest much in it. And that's oversimplifying and not being fair to graphic novels as a genre, but generally that's the kind of thing that I chose, is all I'm saying. There definitely are, like, I have Mouse. I have that graphic novel. I haven't started it yet because I know it's going to be heavy. I do need to read that. But that's probably not going to be something that I do for leisure reading, right? And actually, I need to add that to my books that I'd like to cover. In terms of quick reads that I would do, I would, I'd usually take something that could be read in a kind of episodic way, because the reality is what would happen is I'd have a couple of weeks in between books and I'd think, this is the time where I get to just do pleasure reading and read something that I want to read. And I'd pick something up that I had, you know, an ebook that I had bought a while back. I'd start reading it and then time would get short and I would put it to the side and go back to my podcast reading, and most of the time never get back to it. And so I started favoring books that were a little more chapter-based. So like what I call short topic science fiction, where like an individual chapter is a topic, or short story anthology, that kind of thing. And that allowed me to not feel bad about stopping in the middle of a book because it's something that I can pick up and not really need to remember what came before. So like I have a book like The Baseball 100 by Joe Posnanski. Each chapter is its own thing. It's great for just quickly doing a little bit of reading that's not for the podcast. And very often in the spring of the year, I would pick up a baseball-themed book because I love baseball. Okay. I think I mentioned this in the retrospective, but I did get a comment from Nick who said, I appreciate this podcast and considered donating in the past, but have always stopped short because of subscription fatigue. So he encouraged me to create a mechanism for one-off payments. I have done that. It's buymeacoffee.com/SethHeaselD. For some reason, it's exactly my last name, but chop off the Y and put a D there. I do have one supporter already on Buy Me a Coffee. So if you want to join in there, you can do one-off buy me a book is what it is. All right. Moving on to some more kind of things about Seth. This one is anonymous. How did growing up in Alaska, if I remember correctly, influence your enjoyment of science fiction? Did you ever feel like a deep space colonist? Yes. There was definitely, I 100% resonated with Luke Skywalker's quote from Star Wars about being on the planet farthest from the bright center of the universe. That's what it felt like in Alaska sometimes. Not that I didn't love it. I did love it. It was a great place to grow up. But you do feel very far from the center of the universe. You watch shows about New York City and you're like, that's a strange foreign land, you know, a city like that. Not that there aren't any tall buildings in Anchorage. There are, but they're not very tall, you know, 30 stories. But then, you know, of course, growing up a Star Wars fan, growing up in the 80s, Empire Strikes Back comes out in 1980. I'm 7 years old, 8 years old, maybe. And, it's partially set on Hoth, and I feel like I live on Hoth. We built so many awesome snow forts to help, you know, of course, repel the Empire. We also would take our action figures out into the snow and play with them. And 1 year I lost a Luke Skywalker X-Wing pilot, Luke Skywalker, in the snow, and I found him in March. It definitely does impact my enjoyment of science fiction as well, because I've really been able to get into kind of the mindset of any science fiction that describes being cold. So like Camp Permafrost from the Vore game, the scenes that are set on the moon of Pluto, Charon, in the Forever War, basically all of the Left Hand of Darkness, these really resonate with me. Parts of Ancillary Justice as well, now that I think of it, there's some parts where, I can't remember the name of that character, Breck? Yeah, doesn't matter. It's really cold, and I can feel those passages in my bones. Okay. Moving on. Which book was most surprisingly better on audio than in print, or vice versa? So I mentioned in my retrospective that I didn't always listen to audiobooks for the podcast. I think this person thinks that I did all of the podcast reading on audio. And there are a lot of these books that I didn't listen to audio at all on. There were some of them that I did, or I used it to, for instance, do the homework, like for the Vorkosigan series. I picked up the audiobooks for the books leading up to the Vore game. I will say those audiobooks are absolutely fantastic. I love them in print, but the series that is read by Grover Gardner, it's fantastic. Great character differentiation. Just really wonderful work. The Broken Earth series, another one that I really enjoyed. These are ones that I read and listened to, or kind of shift read, did the whisper sync thing between Kindle and Audible. Those are read by Robin Miles. She's absolutely fantastic. Again, great with character differentiation, great with accents, fantastic. Doomsday Book by Jenny Sterlin, read by Jenny Sterlin, very, very good. The Ancillary series was really, really good as well. I'm going to butcher this name, read by Ajoa Ando. If you can make me enjoy the songs or poems in a prose book, in an audiobook, you are doing it right, and that's exactly what she did. She was terrific. In terms of books that I think are better on audio, all those other ones I was saying are ones that I wholeheartedly recommend if you want to take them in that way. To me, it's a dead heat between the audiobook and reading it in print. The Audio Renaissance versions of the Ender series, so Ender's Game, Speak for the Dead, all of those, I think they're better than the print versions. And Orson Scott Card actually agrees with this. He used to write for theater, and he says that he likes to write as if it's going to be read aloud. And so Stefan Rudnicki, Gabrielle DeCour, and Scott Brick, they're absolutely fantastic in that series. There is one exception. I talked about it on an episode. I think that was for patrons. Yeah. There's one character, the way it's done in Xenocide, that I really, really didn't like, with a narrator that I otherwise love. On the negative side, audiobooks that I didn't care for, I listened to part of The Moon is a Harsh Mistress after I had read the book in print. And something about that one didn't work for me. I think the first-person perspective there, where it was told from the main character who didn't speak fluent English, more or less. It's kind of heavily accented English with, for instance, lots of missing definite or indefinite articles. It makes it hard to read in print. In audio, it just makes it awkward. And I didn't love that. It felt clunky. I also thought that the audio versions of the Mars trilogy, the Kim Stanley Robinson Mars trilogy, I thought they were absolutely dreadful. To be fair, it's hard to imagine that I would have enjoyed any version of those books that weren't like Matrix-style direct brain downloads with no elapsed time. Because, you know, they're 30-hour audiobooks where I got no enjoyment from them. And so it's probably not the narrator's fault, though the character differentiation was very poor. And in books with that many characters, that's a major problem. All right. moving into a couple interesting questions. So this is an anonymous one. Hey, Seth, an alternate universe question for you. What's the eeriest thing that's ever happened to you, like a brush with terrible circumstances where an alternate reality version of you may have suffered something? Two of these kind of come to mind, one with like dismemberment or death, and the other one worse than that. When I was in college, I worked at a place called Bondar Clegg. We worked graveyard shift, so it was all night in Alaska in an open shop, which is actually really nice because it's graveyard shift in Alaska in the summer. Anchorage in the summer is fantastic. But I worked there with my best friend, Chris, and we didn't do a ton of work. We would kind of do several hours of a lot of work and then kind of goof off for the rest of the time. And at some point, Chris said, hey, I'm doing a run to 7-Eleven. You want to come along? And I thought about it, and then I was like, no, I'll stick around here with Dan. And so Dan and I are playing cribbage or something while Chris goes to 7-Eleven. It's not very far away. 20 minutes go by, and we think it's been longer than we would have expected for Chris to go there and come back. And right about that time, the door of the place opens, and Chris comes running in, and he is absolutely covered in blood because he has crashed his pickup into the back of a flatbed. And we, of course, you know, rendered assistance, tried to stem the bleeding, that kind of stuff, called 911, ambulance came, picked him up, took him to the hospital. He had to get a bunch of stitches. He was lucky to walk away with his life from that crash. If I had been with him, I went and looked at where the truck was crashed. The passenger side was absolutely completely crashed in. And so alternate reality version of me would have died if I had gone with him. So that was freaky. That lived in my head for quite a while after that. So you think, what's worse than that? Well, when I was a kid, I had a good friend about halfway down my block. I had another friend who was all the way at the end of the block. And so we would meet at Kevin's house in the middle, and we'd go and play. Well, across the street from him was another kid, and I'm not going to give his name. But this kid had a series of stepdads and sort of creepy pseudo-stepdads. And at some point, we discovered that he had a camper with a bunch of candy in it. And there was also a bunch of porn, a bunch of Playboys and nudie magazines and that kind of stuff. And looking back on that, as an adult, candy and pornography, that was a creeper van, a creeper camper. And none of us realized it at the time. But I do wonder about what was going on in that house. So, yeah, super creepy. Anyhow, shifting gears quite a bit. So somebody, I think this was Russ, actually, who asked and answered as well. Which baseball player who was not Ted Williams would be the best side character in a science fiction novel? And why didn't you automatically pick Yogi Berra? And I have to say, Yogi Berra is absolutely the wrong choice. I think he would absolutely, like, if you were on a long-haul space flight with him, he would be insufferable. He'd be fun for a little bit, and then he would drive you absolutely up the wall. I can't remember if Ted Williams was ever... His family was trying to cryogenically freeze him. I remember that there was a controversy about that. Somebody in his family was trying to do that. And then, of course, you know, he would be a science fiction side character in waiting if he was frozen. For me, I'd have a hard time not picking a Mariner and not picking Ichiro or Ken Griffey Jr. They would all both be a great hang. And then a follow-up question from Russ. Do you regret leaving this form open with a blank text box that nerds feel they need to fill up? And no, Russ, it's all good. Okay, question from Andy. If you could be any hero from any book in the Hugos, who would you be? This was a tough one. I thought about this one for a long time, and I think I have to go with Ned from To Say Nothing of the Dog, with the caveat that I wouldn't be time-lagged, because being time-lagged sounds absolutely dreadful. But like getting to float down the river would be very cool, and I have a huge crush on Verity, of course. And time travel, you know, is very cool. Enter. Really? Interruption of my dog sliding under my desk here and starting to lick my feet. So that was not helpful. And now he's coming over and panting. Really? Really? Okay, a question from Damien. Do you think that the classics of sci-fi from the 40s and 50s will still be read in another decade or beyond? And on a similar theme, will the new wave work from the 60s and 70s stand the test of time? Or is science fiction changing too much? You know, I'm not sure that I'm the right person to answer this one. And this is something that it's a topic I'm interested in, but since I didn't go through in order, I have a hard time kind of latching on to the big, sort of trends in science fiction. But I do think that the classics from the 40s and 50s are classics for a reason. They're the origins of the genre. And for that reason, I think they will continue to be read. Just like, you know, people have not stopped reading Frankenstein. It's a great book and it's a foundational book to the genre. So I think 40s and 50s will still be read, yeah, in another decade or beyond. New wave work, I think some of it will survive. Some of it probably will not. I'm a little more concerned with some of the recent trends in science fiction that I think I'm not sure that a lot of these books will be remembered. I think, like, if I had to say a couple from the recent Hugo winners that I don't think will survive, nah, I'm not going to do that. I think ones that will survive, like the Broken Earth series, I think will be classics forever. I think they're absolutely fantastic and they're applicable to a variety of possible circumstances. Obviously, there's climate change metaphors in there if you want to see them. There's a lot of, they're thematically deep as well. So I think those ones will definitely stand up. Okay, Damien also asked, do you think that it's possible for new writers of quality to become well-known in the field in an era of unedited self-publishing and lengthy series of 500-page behemoths of novels by well-established writers? I think if he was writing this question now, he would include ChatGTP and AI and that kind of stuff. It's a great question, and it's another one that I feel like I'm not sure that I'm totally qualified to answer. I think if you compare it to kind of the flood of streaming media that we've had, I don't feel like it's diluted the product, really. I mean, I guess it undeniably has, but the quality pieces of what we get that we call television, you know, when I look at what my wife and I consume, for instance, it's basically all streaming stuff. We don't watch any of the terrestrial television shows. There's a difference in the quality of what goes into them. And I think, you know, for TV, streaming has unlocked, for instance, things like we don't have to do a 42-minute show. We can do a 20-minute one and then a 41-minute one and then a 70-minute episode if we need to. I like that. I think with publishing, I think writers of quality are always going to rise to the top in the field. I think the self-publishing, I have no experience with self-published science fiction. This would be another great one for J.W. Wartick to talk about. So maybe I'll write that down as a question for him when I have him on. Personally, about the 500-page behemoths, I don't like those. I like shorter books. And so my hope is that new writers who can figure out how to write short books, I hope they are able to become well-known in the field, because we don't need more long books. And maybe that's a hot take, but if you can't tell your story in 350 pages, you're writing a series, not a single book. And occasional long books, I'm totally fine with, but for the most part, editing. Thank you. Please, more of that. And I think, you know, just in terms of the era that we live in, word of mouth goes a long way in the internet age, and the social media, all that kind of stuff. Things that are good will find an audience. At least I hope that is the case. Okay. All right. Moving on from Emily. Do you read horror novels? And then also, what TV shows are you enjoying right now? And what TV shows are your favorites? On the horror novel question, the answer is not really. I have read maybe a dozen actual horror novels, if you would, you know, the ones that are solidly in the genre. There's a lot of kind of horror adjacent stuff that I've read. Like I've read a lot of Dean Koontz, but most of those are more in the thriller category than horror. I'm kind of a wuss, honestly. And when I was a kid, I was prone to nightmares, and so and still I tend to be prone to nightmares, and so I haven't allowed myself to get much into the genre. But I did add the Bram Stoker Awards to my Mondo list of award winners, the infinite list, because I don't want to close off that whole category. And I'm going to be doing an episode about kind of where to get started in horror for one of my zoomed out episodes. So for TV shows, stuff that I'm enjoying right now, I'll get to. But for looking back at my favorites, it's easy for me to go to Star Trek The Next Generation. The new Battlestar Galactica show I really enjoyed. Fringe was a show that I thought was absolutely terrific. Lost its way a little bit toward the end of the run, but really, really enjoyed that. Terminator, The Sarah Connor Chronicles, gone too soon. I'm not going to say Firefly because I did not watch it in the original run. I thought it was good, but I think the fact that it ended early has made people think it's better than it is. I think it's great, but I don't think there's any reason to think that it would have been great for its entire run. I did love Serenity, though. I saw Serenity first, and then I went back and watched Firefly. Stuff that I'm enjoying right now, I just finished watching Silo a couple weeks ago. I thought that was terrific. Big fan of Superman and Lois. I did say that my wife and I don't watch much stuff that's just on normal broadcast television. That still is true, even though Superman and Lois is on broadcast television. But my wife doesn't watch it with me because she's not as much a fan of genre television as I am. I think that show is really good. If you enjoyed their kind of Berlanti universe, the Arrowverse, Superman and Lois is a little more mature because Superman and Lois are a little older. They have teenagers. So this is something that I kind of identify more with because I have an adult son. And I like the dynamic of that pair and the actors, Bitsy Tulloch and Tyler Hoechlin, absolutely fantastic as Superman and Lois. To be honest, most of the science fiction viewing that I do is on my own because my wife isn't a big fan of the genre, like I said. So for other genre stuff that I enjoy, I like New Trek. Not a huge fan of Picard, but I enjoyed the first couple of seasons of Discovery, first season of Strange New Worlds. Honestly, have not really connected to the second season of Strange New Worlds. I thought it got off to a very rocky start. I'm hoping that it gets better. But for other stuff that I watch with my wife, for instance, one thing that we're big fans of is British detective shows. So Foyle's War, Endeavor, Happy Valley, Luther, Broadchurch, Line of Duty, all fantastic. Pretty much, if you find us a newish British detective show, we almost always like it. Some of the older stuff I don't like just because it's shot differently. So, for instance, we loved Endeavor, but I've never watched Inspector Morse, even though Endeavor is a prequel to it. Okay, just a couple of questions left. If you could start any other podcast right now, what would it be? I would do a Danny Kaye podcast. White Christmas and Court Jester are probably his most well-known films, and I love both of them. But I wish more people knew about Wonder Man and The Inspector General and The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which we did cover on Take Me to Your Reader, and things like The Kid from Brooklyn, where he's a boxer. Danny Kaye is a boxer. Yes. Hilarity. So if anybody wants to get on that and, crucially, wants to do the editing for that and do all the work, I will gladly be your co-pilot. Okay, and the last question, and I did get a bit of feedback, and I can't remember if I talked about this in the retrospective, where somebody gave me the comment, religious comments are annoying to non-religious listeners. So if you're one of those, I didn't write the question, somebody wrote in with it. I think it's a good question. I think you might find my answer interesting. Listen to the question, then decide if you want to listen to it. So the question is, you have, of course, referenced your Christian faith, but I wonder what more deep thoughts you have in that area regarding science fiction, thinking about works like Dune or Ancillary Justice, where religion is a component that can be seen as fairly negative. This is a really interesting question, and it's the kind of question you should ask religious people. And I don't feel like you can be an honest religious person without acknowledging the very mixed legacy of organized religion. And this is something where people differ, right? There are people like Christopher Hitchens who think that religion has done nothing good, which I think is a ridiculous assertion and can't be backed up. In fact, there's lots of bad stuff. And science fiction really does make a great venue for examining that question about the legacy of religion. And that's why I actually really love some of the portrayals of religious people in science fiction. I loved Father Roche in Doomsday Book, who's rough around the edges, but also very pious and compassionate. And it contrasts really nicely in that same book with Mrs. Gadsden, who's an overbearing hypocrite. It's really nice to kind of show that difference between people who, in theory, share the same faith, but work it out very differently. And then, you know, I feel like it's absolutely fair. This was another question from Russ. He mentioned Dune, and there's a great portrayal of religion as a tool for manipulation and control. And that is an absolute fair way to look at religion. It absolutely has been used for manipulation and control. And if you don't remember, in Dune, there's the Bene Gesserit, and they have an arm called the Missionaria Protectiva, whose job it is to essentially sow seeds of messianic religion to prepare the ground for the coming of the Kwisatz Haderach. They create prophecies and superstition to help with his rise to power. And that's really gross to me, the idea of doing something like that. Orson Scott Card in Past Watch, subtitled The Redemption of Christopher Columbus, does a similar thing. And I'm really not okay with it. I thought it was an interesting book, but time travelers went back to the Americas in the Middle Ages and sowed seeds to guide the indigenous people to Christianity on the understanding, the belief that Christianity helps kind of push people towards a scientific enlightenment, which I think is fair. And this is where Christopher Hitchens might disagree, but there's something to the idea of monotheistic religions that believe that there's a creator and therefore interrogate the beginnings. And in contradistinction to things like Greek philosophy that would think that the universe was eternal, there's something speculative about religion that can really be gelled in together well with science. If this is an ordered universe that was created by an orderly creator, we should be able to interrogate that order and discover things about it. If the universe is illusory, or if it's eternal, eternal is fine, but illusory, that was one of the things in some Greek thought, that the universe is an illusion. If it's an illusion, there's no point in studying it. If it's created and has order, then we can study that and determine what God did with it. And that's an interesting thing. When you get into reading the kind of history of religion and science, the battles between religion and science tend to be more recent. A long time ago, people did not have any trouble harmonizing their scientific outlook with their Christian faith or their Islamic faith or Jewish faith. But yeah, in Past Watch, that's what they do, is they go back and they manipulate things so that the indigenous peoples of the Americas will, when presented with Christianity, be prepared to accept it and not be slaughtered, of course, by the, quote, Christians that came across to proselytize them. But to my mind, the idea of stamping out, quote, superstitions to replace them with Christianity seems very evil to me. I think of if anybody saw the recent show 1923, which is in the Yellowstone universe, there was 1883 and then 1923, and it shows some of the Indian schools where priests and nuns beat the crap out of Native American girls and boys to get them to be more Western and Christian and suppress their language and suppress their culture. And that's an absolute evil. And I'm appalled by what was done in the name of Christianity. I'm not sure that their souls needed saving, and certainly not at the cost of their culture. So there are also authors like Arthur C. Clarke, who is an atheist and imagines that a future without religion is a better future. And I'm not sure that I agree with that, but it's something to talk about. I also think it's an atheist pipe dream. I know religious people well enough to know that if there were incontrovertible proof, for instance, that Christianity wasn't true, there would be a large segment of Christians who would shrug it off and continue exactly as they were, and probably say that scripture predicted such a rise of doubters and deceivers. So, yeah. And so in the context of religious comments are annoying to non-religious listeners, I just think that kind of comment is really wrongheaded, because there are conversations to be had, and we grow from hearing from a variety of perspectives, and our lives are poorer if all we hear is agreement. So I'd be interested to hear from you on that, you know, if you're a religious or non-religious person, what you think of portrayals of religion in fiction. And, you know, I've gotten some comments from atheists, listeners, that they felt included in conversations that have touched on matters of faith. So, okay, I have come to the end of my list of questions. If you have other questions for me, I can start collecting them for another one of these, or you can just reach out to me on social media, and I'm happy to answer questions that way. Or you can come on my podcast and ask me your questions in person, or have me on your podcast, and we can talk about whatever you want, especially if it's baseball or Danny Kaye. That'd be great. So once again, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoy Hugo's There 2.0. We will be starting next month. I have an episode getting ready to go. I have a couple of exciting one-off episodes that I'm going to be doing that I think are going to be fun as well. Author interviews, that kind of thing. Every now and then I read a book and I think it's interesting and I reach out to the author and they agree to come on. And I have one of those coming up that I'm really excited about. And then I'll also be working on the Zoomed Out episodes. I even have my little sister who's going to come on to do one of those. So that'll be fun. So yeah, thanks again for listening. Thank you to everybody who nominated this podcast, and thanks in advance to anyone who votes for it for the Hugo Award. Let me know if you have any feedback on this episode or, you know, anything else. feedback@hugospodcast.com, or reach out to me on Twitter, as long as it keeps existing, @HugosPodcast. I'll find a way to be on different social media if that one completely goes away, though I'm terrible at adopting new social media things, and so I really haven't done any of that. So if you're on other social media platforms, send me an invite, and then maybe I'll get over onto whichever platform you're on. All right. Thanks again for listening, and I'll talk to you in Hugo's There 2.0. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.